This podcast of NPR's On Point with Tom Ashbrook is a production of WBUR Boston.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. News from the Pentagon this weekend that the U.S. Army is now promoting 97% of all captains to the rank of major. A dramatic jump in promotion rates and more evidence, say critics inside the military and out, that the Army is lowering standards because it is stretched too thin. Last week, two reports out saying the Army is coming dangerously close to a breaking point, stretched and overstretched by the war in Iraq. Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld responded heatedly last week, saying, in effect, balderdash. But the warnings keep coming. Up next on Point, the thin green line, and loud warnings now of a U.S. Army stretched to its limits. Joining me now from Alexandria, Virginia, is Tom Bowman. He is military affairs correspondent for the Baltimore Sun. Tom, thanks very much for being with us.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Summarize, if you would, for us these two reports last week. Who did they come from? What was their bottom line?
Well, one of the reports was put out by a former Defense Secretary William Perry and former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright. And the other was by a highly respected defense analyst Andy Krepinevich from the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessment.
Krepinevich, a former Army officer and West Point grad, he was contracted to do this for the Army.
Right. And both studies point to the problems with the United States Army. And I think Andy Krepinevich put it right. He said storm clouds are on the horizon. And he points to the high divorce rate in the Army, the increased number of captains who are leaving. They've doubled the number of low-performing recruits, and they've raised the age limit for recruits. So if you look at some of those indicators, the Army is in trouble. Is it broken? Nobody can say for sure right yet, but it's clearly struggling.
Tom, when people talk about the Army being at risk of breaking, what exactly do they mean? What would a broken Army be? Does that simply mean an Army that cannot recruit enough to keep its manpower levels up, its person power levels?
Right, that would be one indicator that you couldn't fully man the units, the combat units. Also, some of your mid-manager types, the captains, the senior sergeants, would be leaving the backbone of the Army. And this happened shortly in the middle of and after the Vietnam War when it became broken. And it took a decade to rebuild the Army with some officers such as Colin Powell.
A decade to rebuild the Army, but the Army's been so vigorously at grips with conflict lately. Donald Rumsfeld points at and says, how can you say this Army's at broken or even at risk? He says, I see it as battle-hardened, as more vigorous than ever because it's in the thick of it.
No, there's no question that the soldiers today probably have more combat experience than any Army maybe since the Civil War or certainly World War II. But there are strains. Again, recruits they're bringing in now are lower quality recruits. They've doubled that number. And again, the captains are starting to leave at a higher rate, and the sergeants as well. So there's a concern that the Army is fraying at this point.
We saw a report.
Clearly, they're more experienced than ever.
We saw a report over the weekend that the promotion now from captain to major, historically a big winnowing point in the Army, is up to 97%. It used to be down in 70-something percent. What does that indicate, Tom?
Well, that it's clearly easy to become a major these days. And the question is, are these the best quality captains? If it's so easy to rise to the rank of major, who are these people, and are they of high caliber? And again, are the better captains leaving because they have better job opportunities?
We're told that the U.S. military is looking to draw down its troop numbers in Iraq this year. And we're reading here that it's presented as being driven by the circumstances there. But in fact, it may be driven by exactly this strain on the Army, that they feel they have to get back and let these folks rest up, not do so many multiple tours of duty, or the Army won't be in shape for what might be asked next.
Right. That's absolutely right. Clearly, the generals have one eye on the situation in Iraq and the other eye on the Army and how it's performing and how strained it is. You talk privately to people in the Pentagon, they say there's no question that what they're doing here is reducing the number of troops in Iraq because of the strains on the Army.
You were at the Pentagon last week when Don Rumsfeld fired back, and he fired back hard. In fact, you were going sort of head-to-head with the Secretary of Defense over some of these issues. What bone of contention did you have there, Tom Bowman?
Well, last year they were looking to increase the number of Army combat units to 77. And they were on the Hill telling the Congress that they needed 77 brigades for future operations. That's the number they thought they would need. And now they've dropped that number to 70. And what they're saying is that a new strategy review by the Pentagon shows that they just need 70 combat brigades. But people I talk with say it's clearly being driven more by budget constraints than by any strategy. So we had a little argument, I guess you could say, about that.
And on the recruiting front, I'm seeing here just 700 new recruits in December for the Army. Are they going to make their targets this year? Are they changing those targets, lowering them to make it easier to hit them? And what's
some of the months they're lowering, and clearly they lowered December. I'm not sure what the original number was, but it's just 700. Their goal for the month of December, they exceeded that by maybe 40 or 50 or so.
But isn't that an amazingly low number for an Army and country of this size?
Oh, it certainly is, yeah. And there's also some talk, although the Army denies it, there's some talk privately that they may increase the number of lower quality recruits sometime next summer.
And Tom, finally, if I may, what about, there's criticism from outside here, one of these reports is sponsored by the Democrats, but what about inside the military? Is this an active debate among active duty officers?
Oh, absolutely. There's no question. There's a great deal of concern about the health of the United States Army, but with many of these officers, they're afraid to come out publicly because it would be counter to what Secretary Rumsfeld is saying and the Army leadership.
It sure would, at least last week, and loud and clear. Tom Bowman, thanks very much for being with us.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Tom Bowman, military affairs correspondent for the Baltimore Sun. He spoke with us from Alexandria, Virginia. I want to welcome into our conversation now from Washington, Tom Donnelly. He's a resident fellow in defense and security policy studies at the American Enterprise Institute. He's also editor of the Armed Forces Journal. He's been watching the U.S. military for a long time. Tom Donnelly, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me. It's a cavalcade of Toms.
We've got all kinds of Toms here. Give us your top-level response to I'm sure this is not a new critique to you, but it's gotten a lot of public exposure in the last week. The thin green line, the overstretched Army, the Army at risk of breaking. Do you agree? Is it?
I'm not so sure that breaking is the right or the most the thing that worries me the most. One thing that's been left out of the discussion so far is simply maintaining the current level of force in Iraq the right strategy for Iraq? I mean, as important as it is to maintain the Army as an institution capable of conducting this long war, we also ought to include the question of how we ought to actually fight the war. And the one strategic choice that we're constrained from making is, and has been now for several years, is actually increasing the size of the force in Iraq, which is a theme that one also hears from soldiers deployed to Iraq equally, if not more frequently, than the question of the stretch on the force.
Is the implication of that in this conflict that we're in the midst of right now, the Army is already in some sense broken, that it doesn't have enough manpower to deploy enough troops to the field?
Well, the units, within units, I mean, the performance of units is just been phenomenal, and that extends also to National Guardsmen.
So individual units, nobody's arguing about their performance, but overall.
Right. We don't want to sort of miss the forest for the trees here.
And the overall picture, I ask again, is it that we have a problem with the structure of the Army in Iraq now, that there's not enough manpower, person power there, to do the job?
I think that's been my view, and it's certainly been the testimony of soldiers anecdotally and the conclusion of a variety of reports for a number of years now.
Last week, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld pushed back very hard in a long news conference on this. Here he is pushing back against these new reports saying that the Army, not that it's broken, but that it could be. And here's the Secretary.
The force is not broken. The implication in what you said is also, I think, almost backwards in this sense. The world saw the United States military go halfway around the world and in a matter of weeks throw the Al-Qaeda and Taliban out of Afghanistan in a landlocked country, thousands and thousands of miles away. They saw what the United States military did in Iraq. And the message from that is not that this armed force is broken, but that this armed force is enormously capable.
Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld last week. Of course, interestingly, no one has said it is broken. The point that's been raised is that it is at risk of breaking if recruitment's not there, if quality standards are lowered, if the tours of duty in Iraq and Afghanistan come too thick and too fast. We're joined now from Monterey, California, from member station KAZU, by John Arquilla. He's professor of defense analysis at Naval Postgraduate School there. John Arquilla, thank you very much for being with us.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Give us your assessment. We're trying to listen very carefully to all sides here. We can imagine the Secretary of Defense hardly wants to say that he has a military at risk of being broken. I mean, he's got potential adversaries looking on. What do you make of the debate, John?
Well, I don't think we're broken or even at serious risk of that happening. We have plenty of troops to do what's needed if we do things right. And the Secretary focused on Afghanistan, where how many people remember we took down the Taliban and al-Qaeda with just over 300 of our troops on the ground? There was a whole different concept of operations. When we went to Iraq, there was a debate about whether that Afghan model might apply. Some of us thought a version of it, what we called Afghanistan Plus. The military traditionalists wanted what we called Desert Storm Minus, a very, very large army doing things in more traditional ways. And Rumsfeld compromised in between the two, not a 500,000 force, not just 50,000, but about 250,000 troops. And it's that compromise that we're seeing worked out rather uncomfortably right now. And so the critics have a point. If we keep doing business in the wrong way in terms of the counterinsurgency in Iraq, we are going to impose strains. And I, for one, am most concerned about the possibility of a crisis on the Korean Peninsula erupting in some kind of warfare. And if that happened, you've got a million troops in the north, and you have U.S. military very heavily deployed to Iraq. And so the situation strategically could be very uncomfortable. But I think what is needed most in this debate is a reinsertion of the notion of what kind of doctrine would we employ and what kind of military organization. Does everything have to be the brigade of a couple of thousand fighters? In Afghanistan, small teams of a couple of dozen got a lot done. And even today in the counterinsurgency, they're sending out troops in squads of 8 to 12 men at a time to winkle out the Taliban. And in 2005, over 1,000 of their fighters were killed in close-up firefights with our small units. We're an enormously capable military, and if we focus on issues of organization and doctrine, we'll find that we're far from broken.
Tom Donnelly, John Arquilla raises the issue of doctrine, but are we not sort of caught here between two visions of the world? I mean, the push in maybe the late 90s, certainly the early part of the Bush administration, was for a much lighter kind of lightning strike force. We saw that working effectively in Afghanistan and in the toppling of Saddam. But now we've seen, as you say, Tom Donnelly, that the aftermath is requiring an awful lot of troops and maybe more. Can we look at this lighter, quicker army and say we're all right for that when we've got demands for tens or hundreds of thousands of troops out there?
Well, yeah. I mean, the problem is the invasion, the strike, is only the beginning of the war. And winning that battle as quickly and as decisively as possible is obviously not disconnected from what is to follow. But, you know, the Afghanistan model ought to include what happened after the toppling of the Taliban. There are something like 16,000 soldiers, American soldiers, now in Afghanistan. We've had as many as 20,000 during crisis periods like election periods and so on and so forth. That number has not gone down, just as the Iraq number has not gone down.
From what we read, what we hear, it's taking a toll. I want to hear from our callers here. Bill is calling from Indian Head, Maryland. Hi, Bill, you're on the air.
Hi. I'll give you a quick litany of things that I've observed and then let you comment on them if you'd like. I am in the Army Reserve, and after 9/11, I went and took a recruiting mission, and we had recruiting was very high.
Yeah.
I recently was talking to recruiters where they're adding more recruiters to an office and they're not making their quotas. And I wouldn't say the Army is broke, but I would say that we're walking wounded. In particular, things you have to understand, the war is eating up a lot of resources. So over there, we have problems with getting enough bullets, getting enough batteries, getting enough tires for our Humvees. But when a unit went over, a reserve unit went over that I went over on my second tour, we went over with 44 trucks. We came back with four. We left 40 in country. Now, once you leave your entire armor supply and equipment there, you can't train. You can't go out in the field. You can't bivouac. You can't do any of that work.
So, Bill, you did two tours in Iraq in addition to your recruiting work, and you're saying it's not broken, but it's sounding pretty stretched.
It is stretched, and they're wrong on the thin green line. It's the thin brown line because we're all brown now. But right. Coming back, I came back, and I'm a military police officer, and mm-hmm. I came back to an MP unit, which we will be training in 2 months. We will be training on grenades using softballs because we don't have enough grenades to be able to throw or the ability to go out. Also, schools are being cut because we're on a deployment schedule, so reserves don't get schools, and when they don't get schools, they don't get promoted.
Schools, that's training for advancing through the ranks, and you say that's not happening.
Right. The junior enlisted advance very quickly, but the senior enlisted are not getting their packages completed because of being at war all the time and not being able to attend school. And the last comment I'll make is the fact that I just transferred to a different military police unit, walked into the unit. They do have attendance problems, and they actually are closing the unit down and consolidating it with another section. Usually units are in three or four different locations, and they're consolidating all these simply because the different locations are not supporting enough personnel, so they're trying to keep up enough end strength and make it look better by actually putting everybody in one location.
Bill, we've got it. That's a great report from the front, and we're grateful to you for sharing it with us. Let me get another voice in here as well. Tony's calling from Tampa, Florida. Hi, Tony. What have you seen?
Well, I've seen, my husband's been in the Army for 24 years, and, you know, we always thought that he would stay in for 30 or as long as they would keep him. But in the last 36 months, he's spent 24 of it away. He's gone to Afghanistan, Iraq, spent a year in Kuwait, and we're just sick and tired of it. And I think most of the families we know who have been really dedicated to sticking it out for the long haul are saying, you know, enough is enough. Going once, great. Twice even is not so bad, but that third time is the killer. And it's just as bad for reservists. And your last caller is an MP. My goodness, they are gone all the time. And they were gone from their families all the time before Iraq kicked off.
Tony, you're a military wife then with a lot of experience here. It's clearly had, it takes a toll on your family and others. But how do you see it in terms of the national security? Do you see this as putting the United States at risk when the stretch gets this long?
You know, without getting into, you know, my personal belief that the whole Iraq war was a bad idea, I do think that it is endangering national security because a lot of experienced senior people who are most skilled are now seriously considering getting out and going into the civilian sector because it is taking such a toll on their families. And my goodness, when you're promoting 97% of captains to major, I think as you quoted early in your program, that's a phenomenal rate. I hate to use the word, but there are some dirtballs who are going to be majors, and those are the people who are going to be considered for battalion command. And, you know, that really, battalion command is where the rubber hits the road and where the real, you know, life and death decisions are made.
Tony, we really appreciate your eye of experience on this as well. Thank you for calling in.
Thank you.
John Arquilla, let me come to you with these two callers. I mean, they just, you know, sort of open the phone lines, and there they are. Bill saying, look, we're throwing softballs instead of grenades, and people, and we've got units that can't be supported because the staff isn't there. And you heard Tony saying, we're sick and tired of being sick and tired. It's taking a toll at that intimate level, John.
Well, it almost beggars the imagination that a military spending $1.25 billion every single day can't buy enough grenades. But the problem is we have an industrial policy budget that spends hundreds of billions of dollars on Cold War legacy systems. Secretary Rumsfeld has only been able to stop the Comanche helicopter and the Crusader artillery piece in his 5 years in office. And that is something that has to change. As far as this whole problem, obviously the conversation crackles around Iraq. And I'll come back to my point. We need to organize differently. We need to fight differently to win there. That doesn't mean more troops. More troops means the flies will have conquered the flypaper. What we have to do is look again at that Afghan model. As Tom Donnelly said, less than 20,000 troops are doing a very, very fine job over there. That's something like a tenth of the force that's in Iraq, that in a country of similar size and about the same population. And it seems to me that That's something that the Pentagon is loath to look at because, frankly, the traditionalists like the idea that the worst legacy system of all was the Powell Doctrine, the notion of overwhelming force.
Mm-hmm.
This is an age when you have to work with precision force tailored to the problem at hand.
I'll put that to Tom Donnelly, but let me come back to you first on it. If the strategy is not changed, and so far there's no word that it's going to be, does that press the Army beyond what it's capable of, John? Does it put us at risk if the Korean Peninsula flares up?
Well, we're certainly at risk if Korea flares up already, although in my view, the necessity of fighting with smaller numbers in Korea would force us to fight innovatively as we did in Afghanistan. See, our problem is we have the luxury of excess in Iraq, and so we've behaved with excessive force, right from the shock and awe bombing to the size of the occupation. You know, what's interesting to me is that doctrinal and organizational innovation is happening from the bottom up in Iraq.
Mm.
Lieutenants and captains, by the way, there's a website called companycommander.com for company commanders,
right,
where they share their best practices with each other, and they do remarkable things in the field. And this is a war. It's not like World War II where you knew every general's name. There's no Patton in Iraq, but there's a lot of captains who are winning the war on the ground, a lot of Marines reinvigorating the old civic action program from Vietnam, small detachments in towns here and there, and they are capturing back a large part of the country, but it doesn't mean large numbers are necessary.
Tom Donnelly, how about it? Could we avoid this stretch and maybe this snap with just a different policy, a different way of deploying in Iraq?
Well, yeah, we could, but the question is, does John have the right picture of what the war is in Iraq, and does he make a false analogy from Afghanistan? In Afghanistan, we toppled a Taliban that had come to power after 30 years of the most devastating warfare imaginable in Afghanistan. Essentially, the Afghans were sick of war. And so our reconstruction effort in Afghanistan has been far easier than it has been in Iraq because these are fundamentally different situations that we find ourselves in. And again, you have to, I just would say you have to take the war as you find it. You have to, you know, distinguish one campaign from another and let the facts speak for themselves. And those same company commanders whom John rightly cites as the people who best know what the situation on the streets is, almost to a man, have complained about their inability to maintain presence, to when they go into a town and they are quite successful in rooting out insurgent units and bringing units up, you know, insurgent attacks down.
Right.
The problem is that they then have to be dispatched to another area, and surprise, surprise, the bad guys come out of the woodwork.
And back
and that's,
it goes.
Look, there may be technologies that could ameliorate some of that problem, but at the end of the day, this is a manpower-intensive kind of fighting.
Let me get a call from Joe in Easton, Massachusetts. Hi, Joe. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you doing?
We're well. What do you know, Joe?
Well, you know, just my background. I fought in a couple of wars as a Marine. My son fought in Ramadi. And I've got to make a statement, not pejoratively. I just think Rumsfeld, as a Vietnam veteran, I look at Rumsfeld, and I think he's the most brilliant and competent to lead the Pentagon since McNamara.
The most brilliant incompetent. What do you mean?
Yeah, I mean, people put so much faith during my time in Vietnam into McNamara. And now we look and we see just what ghastly mistakes he made. And you know, Rumsfeld can't admit the Army's broken. I mean, one, for morale, and two, it would be basically admitting how poorly he's done. But there's a lot of talk about tactics going on here.
Mm-hmm.
The American soldier, I fought as a grunt in Vietnam.
Yep.
I was a pilot in the Gulf War. The American soldier is expected to fight well. I don't think anybody who's on your panel would say that they're not. They get paid to win battles. You had a few people say that we toppled the Taliban. Well, that's a military nitwit saying we've toppled them. We defeated them in some battles, but we're still fighting them. That's the kind of talk that gets people killed because we don't face the fact that we haven't toppled anybody yet.
Can the Army be broken? Is it broken? Is it at risk of being broken?
Well, let me ask you this. You can put this to your pundits.
Yeah.
The Army, to me, is headed towards disaster. My son came back from Ramadi. I kind of got some. As a Marine, I look at it differently.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm an outsider to the Army. But let me just put it to you this way. They're lowering their mental category. They're taking men in their 40s, which I'm 55, but anybody in their 40s, he's not going to serve in the infantry unless he's special.
Right.
Two, less capable leadership. The rate of promotion is gone up to 90-some percent. Mm-hmm. The divorce, suicide, and drug rates in the Army are pretty high. I think nobody will argue that. The Navy and Air Force has to supply, and they can comment on this, logisticians. I think it was 30,000 of them in the last year or two. 5 days of training sent to Iraq to drive trucks because the Army is low on that.
And off they go. Joe, we've got to hold it there. We appreciate your call. Thank you very much for it. Good luck to your son. Let me take a call from Silver Spring, Maryland. Gordon Adams is calling. Gordon Adams at George Washington University?
Right.
Welcome. What's your view, Mr. Adams?
I'm listening to this discussion with a great deal of interest because I think this is a hot issue, Tom. Oddly enough, I find myself in the curious position of agreeing with Donald Rumsfeld, which will shock some people.
In what respect exactly?
Well, in the following sense. Right now we have on active duty, in fact, in the Army, over 600,000 people, mostly because we've called up reserve and guard.
I should point out, you were a budget official in the Pentagon for, what, 4 or 5 years during the Clinton administration, so you're close to this.
I was at the Office of Management and Budget for 5 years at the beginning of the Clinton administration.
Mm, okay.
Right.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. The recruiting data that you're talking about, the 700 in December, I agree
yes.
with the last caller.
Don't put too much weight on 1 month.
It's too much put weight on 1 month, but also it's important to say that if we're falling short in Army recruitment and retention and Guard and Reserve reenlistments, it says that the whole argument of saying we need more is basically futile. It's not going to happen. We will not be able to recruit, both because the war isn't especially popular and because of people have been rotated a lot and because the economy is good. But the point I want to make, Tom, is that this may also not be necessary. That is to say, we're worrying about if we had to keep repeating Iraq, would we have enough troops to repeat Iraq? I don't think we're going to repeat Iraq, and I think the issue is going to be the mission. What are we asking the forces to do? And there, I think, actually, the Rumsfeld and the forthcoming QDR are pretty much on point, that we're going to be looking at a rather widespread conflict with terrorist organizations where not just the military, but a lot of other government institutions are going to be involved. The special operations forces are going to have to grow, and they're going to be proposed to grow. But the problem here is we need to get the right point on the tip of the spear, not a larger spear. In any case, we can't get a larger spear, so it means we really need to focus on the mission.
Gordon Adams, let me put that question to the man who's put the stick in a lot of this over the last few days and get his view on it. We're grateful for your call. Thanks for listening. Thanks for calling in. With us right now is Andrew Krepinevich. His report, commissioned by the Pentagon, came out publicly last week, the thin green line theme, the risk of breaking the Army. Andrew Krepinevich joins us now. Mr. Krepinevich, thanks very much. What do you think of Donald Rumsfeld's response to your warning?
Well, unfortunately, Secretary Rumsfeld, as he said, hasn't had a chance to read the report yet. It's rather lengthy, about 140 pages, and this whole section in terms of the issue of a broken Army, it takes about 3 pages in the overall assessment.
But you do say the Army is in a race against time.
That's right. And in a sense, Secretary Rumsfeld and I are talking past one another. His comments were that the Army is not broken, and I think most military observers would agree with him. Certainly I would. There has been no indication that the Army in the field has suffered any kind of a serious erosion in terms of its combat effectiveness or capability. The question, however, is what about the Army over the longer term? You know, the Army says that in order to sustain the force that it needs, it has to establish at least a 3-to-1 rotation base. And what that means is if you want to deploy a brigade of soldiers forward, you have to have at least 2 brigades back. And that way, forces don't rotate into a war zone too often so that you can't recruit or retain soldiers in the Army.
But you've just heard Gordon Adams from the Clinton administration saying, look, we just don't have that. We simply have to change our strategy rather than bemoan the lack of manpower.
Well, I think Gordon is right to some extent because right now if you said that to the Army you can increase to the size you think you need, the problem is the Army is having recruiting problems. They really can't very well recruit to the force size they have now. So to say to them, we'll increase the size of the army, the answer is likely to be, well, we can't fill the ranks now the way we'd like to.
In your estimate, Andy Krepinevich, how long can the U.S. Army keep up the kind of deployment that it has now in Iraq without doing serious long-term damage to national security, to army health?
Nobody knows the answer to that question. The answer to that question resides in the minds of thousands of young men and women in this country, whether or not they're going to enlist in the Army, and if they're in, whether or not they're going to stay. So nobody, not Rumsfeld, not me, not Gordon Adams, knows the answer to that question. What you do get concerned about, though, is when you see the kinds of difficulties we've had recruiting young people into the military and the fact that the Army's had to lower its standards. And you realize that if this army does hit the wall or confront an institutional crisis where there really is a massive recruitment or retention problem, that is a lot harder to fix than the effort to take preventive steps now. The assessment, what I argue to do is to reduce some of the strain on the army by lowering the force levels we have in Iraq from the 136,000 to 160,000 that we have had, down to a level that's closer to 90 to 100,000. And I also provide a series of steps that would enable us to do that while still retaining the overall effectiveness, the overall progress we're making in defeating the insurgency in Iraq.
Andy Krepinevich, we've had so many good callers. I want to get one more here, an Army recruiter calling from Boston. Travis, you're on the air. Our time is short. What do you see, Travis?
I didn't really want to make a comment about how our retention was going, because I think it varies as far as what areas you have. I just want to throw a comment in real quick about the unit that was training with softball. And I'll tell you, one of my experiences when I was over in Iraq was we were so short on people. We went over there, I'm not sure, maybe 80-85% that our guard towers had to be staffed dummies. We had to make dummies and put them up there and rotate them around at different shifts.
You put dummies in the guard towers, and we'd like to know more, but our time is too short. That's a tough one. John Arquilla, there's an Iraq vet, an American soldier putting dummies in the guard towers. Is that just ingenuity or a sign of trouble?
Oh, ingenuity. One of my students in Afghanistan put a mannequin up at the top of a mountain pass, and Al-Qaeda stopped using the pass for months, and the intercepted radio conversation said, "Don't go that way. The Americans have it manned all the time." So that kind of deception is great. Let me just say, if I may,
our time is very short. If you could go straight to it.
Iraq is like other wars. It's a time portal. You see both the power of the past and the allure of the future. The past is dominant right now with the notion of lots and lots of troops on the ground. The possibility exists, as it existed in Afghanistan, to do more with less, which is, I think, one of the powerful themes of Andy Krepinevich's study. And we have to look at issues in organization and doctrine if we're going to get out of this problem.
Tom Donnelly, the last word, I guess, goes to you. Can we do this with dummies and mannequins?
I'd rather not, all things considered.
Tom Donnelly, it's been great speaking with you. Thanks a lot for joining us.
My pleasure.
John Arquilla in Monterey, California. John, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
And Andy Krepinevich, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
In a moment, one mother's worry for her son serving in Iraq. This is On Point. Over the past 3 years, writer Sue Diaz has been helping us to keep up with the experiences of her son, Sergeant Roman Diaz. We've followed Roman through basic training, his first tour of duty in Iraq, his brief time at home, his promotion to sergeant in the Army's 101st Airborne Division, and now his second tour of duty outside Baghdad. Not long ago, Sue received the phone call that every military mother dreads.
If I could, I begin this with my son's account of what happened to him and the men of his Bravo Company unit at 2:30 in the afternoon, December 22, 2005. Roman and his squad were on foot patrol somewhere in the south of Baghdad. An insurgent's bomb exploded. That much I know. But I can only tell my side of this story right now. And it begins with a call from an Army captain. "Is this Susan Diaz?" a man's voice said when I answered the phone in my office here at home the day before Christmas Eve. He sounded like a telemarketer, so I answered with a wary, "Yes." The man, all business, introduced himself, Captain Kandrian, 101st Airborne, then went on to say that our son had sustained injuries caused by an IED. I sat down, slowly. "That's an improvised explosive device, ma'am." No need for that extra bit of information. These days, those three letters are as familiar as PTA used to be. Above the thumping of my heart, I heard Captain Kandrian relate details of what he called the incident. I fumbled for a pen and wrote down these words: perforated eardrum, peppered face, treated at the aid station at Mahmoudia. Does this mean Roman will get to come home? I asked, hoping. No, ma'am. His injuries are listed as not serious. I wrote down "not seriously injured" in big black letters, underlined those words 3 times, drew a box around them. Your son should be back with his unit soon, but you might not hear from him for a few days because of the news blackout over there. News blackout? What do you mean? I asked. The captain explained, reluctantly, that when soldiers from a unit have been killed, no one from that group is allowed to phone or email until the next of kin have been notified. Oh, I murmured as that sunk in. Some soldiers died in the attack? Yes, ma'am. Do you know their names? Yes, ma'am, but I can't tell you that. Roman had been promoted to sergeant and squad leader just before this second deployment of his began. When he was home on his last leave, I'd heard him talk with an almost paternal affection about the guys in his group. While stationed at Fort Campbell, Kentucky, in the months before being deployed, he'd shared dinner at the homes of some of them, played cards with their parents, met their wives, high-fived their kids. "It's up to me now to make sure they all come home," Roman had said of the men he'd been assigned to lead. One was lost in the attack, we later learned. The news blackout ended on Christmas Eve with this email to his dad and me. "Just wanted to send you guys a quick note and wish you Merry Christmas," he wrote. "I love you both so much and rarely get a chance to tell you these days. I really wish I could be back there to celebrate with you. If I concentrate real hard, I can almost taste the shrimp you cook every year, Mom, even though it isn't my favorite." I smiled at the wise guy honesty of that last statement. It was so Roman. He signed off with Sergeant Diaz and added this: "P.S., if you guys make it to church, say a prayer for the men of Bravo Company. It's been a rough deployment so far. Any prayers are appreciated." That was it. No mention of the incident, not a word about his injuries, and a telling silence on the subject of the fallen. "He doesn't know we know," I realized. We've since talked with him on the phone. "I can't believe they did that," he said when he heard with his good ear that the Army had called us. "As far as he's concerned right now, the less said, the better. It's a matter of protection, I think. Ours, certainly, and maybe his own, too. Our son has learned much about life the hard way lately, but it seems to me there's something he doesn't as yet completely comprehend, or perhaps has come to understand all too well. It is this: when he and his men are out on a mission, they are not alone. Whether we agree with this war or not, those of us who love them are out there too. Moms and dads, kids and cousins, sisters and brothers, neighbors and friends. Every time an insurgent bomb blows apart a Humvee or a squad on foot patrol, the shockwaves from the blast reverberate in small towns like Wheeler, Texas, and big cities like San Diego. A young private takes a bullet. Back at home, his father's heart bleeds. A soldier loses a leg. His wife struggles in the days that follow to simply keep putting one foot in front of the other. A sergeant's eardrum is perforated. His mother hears the explosion in her dreams time and time again. In a later email, Roman wrote, "I'm fine, functioning, and back at work with my men, right where I belong." We are there too, Sergeant Diaz. We are there too.
Sue Diaz is a contributor to On Point in the Christian Science Monitor. She lives in San Diego, California. Her son, Sergeant Roman Diaz, is with the Army's 101st Airborne Division, south of Baghdad. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.